ASA Stories of Value is brought to you by Tagnify. With an affordable, all-in-one solution, let Tagnify simplify your guideline public company method and transaction comps. With robust data sets, easy integration into your models, and now M&A transaction data, Tagnify makes your BV process more profitable. For more info or to schedule a demo, visit Tagnify.com today. Tagnify, the modern financial data platform for innovative business valuation professionals. Hello and welcome to Stories of Value, ASA's podcast where we look at the human side of the appraisal profession. I'm your host, John Russell. I'm pleased to be joined today by Mike Gregory. Mike is an accredited senior appraiser in business valuation who spent 28 years, there are prison sentences shorter than that, by the way, working for the Internal Revenue Service, but spent 11 of those years as a territory manager, had a fantastic career at the Internal Revenue Service. That would have been enough. But this guy, he wasn't done. He's gone out, he's reinvented himself, and he's been running Michael Gregory Consulting since leaving the Internal Revenue Service. It's a firm that does a lot of different things, but really a focus on collaboration, conflict resolution, a whole host of things that you wouldn't necessarily think for a guy who spent his career doing valuations at the IRS. And he's written not one, not two, but 11 books. So clearly very busy. His most recent book is Business Valuations and the IRS. It's actually 5 books in one. So there you go. For the price of one book, you'll get 5. Mike, I'm absolutely thrilled to have you. Thank you for taking the time to sit down with me.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
So before we get into the book, I find your career fascinating because most people think of government service. You go in, it's a noble profession. You know, I'm married to someone who works for the government, and I understand like it's a very, you have to have just a different mindset to decide, I'm going to go work for the government. And then you transition out and you start this completely new company and go well beyond just kind of the traditional bounds of what people think of when they think of business valuation. What was that transition like for you to go from A to B? What has that whole process been like?
When I worked for the federal government, I was innovative there too. And I grew groups. I started up a new research function. I was involved with the startup of the new business valuation and engineering function in the IRS in the year 2000. Those were all creative things, but within the constraints of the government. Within the government, everything has to be approved. Everything has to be approved typically by multiple levels. So actually, when I first went into the private sector, I did not know how to do marketing. So I had to reach out to 6 others who were my mentors, and they gave me very specific tips on what to do and how to proceed. One of the best tips that I received was you needed to get in front of 5 people a week. I said, how do I get in front of 5 people a week? And this individual helped me figure out, Mike, you want to reach out to estate and gift tax attorneys, tax departments, those types of folks, and let them know what you can do to help them to help resolve their conflicts that they were having with IRS, for example. So one of the elements was marketing. Second was I now had freedom that I had not had. So the first conference I went to was an ASA conference in Chicago. I didn't have to have anyone's approval. It was my own firm. I felt guilty about going to an ASA conference and not having to ask anyone for approval. Well, that was now 8 years ago. I've moved well on beyond that since. But those were some of the mental elements that I had to go through on making a transition from government to opening my own firm.
It's almost like you needed to look around and say, who's going to let me do this thing here?
That's right.
So one of the things I want to kind of dig into is people, I think they have, and I'm guilty of it too, but we have an outside perception of the Internal Revenue Service. And then there's how it actually works on the inside. Kind of at a 30,000 foot level, what's one big misconception that practitioners or even just your average taxpayer has about dealing with IRS?
Well, I think first of all, there is not one IRS. The IRS has 13 business divisions. It has 70,000 employees. When you put that together, you have a full bell-shaped curve. At any one time, 5% of the employees are on an opportunity period, meaning they're not performing satisfactorily. That's 1 out of 20. At any one given time, 10% are in the employee assistance program. That means they have something going on financially, children that are juvenile delinquents, drugs, alcohol, gambling issues, who knows what it is. That's actually less than the private sector overall, putting those numbers together. But that's what it's like at the IRS. having been an executive and having headed out of programs nationally for the IRS, and I was on the Equal Employment Opportunity for the commissioner to do an analysis of how we're doing on Equal Employment Opportunity and things. So I got a chance to look at the whole IRS program. With that in mind, you also have folks who are the stars. 10% are the stars. And just like at GE with Jack Welch comes in and says, he says, well, you got about 40% after that that are very good, solid performers. But then you have somewhere between 30 and 40% that they're there and that's their job. And they look at it as their job. So when you work with folks at the IRS, realize you're working with an individual. They may have a full spectrum of those types of perspectives on what they do. But overall, the folks that are there, they're dedicated. They're trying to do the right thing. They want to work it out with the taxpayer. They're there, actually, and they view themselves as public servants. But some have been there for quite a while, and they might have a perception that it's us against them. So the current commissioner, David Coiter, he came out with a commentary after recently another commissioner just passed away, Mortimer Kaplan. And he was a World War II guy. He was 103 years old. He was a beach commander at Normandy. But this guy wrote, or this guy on his watch, came out with a revenue procedure, 64-21. So it's 1964-21. It's ancient. But it said, when you work for the IRS, you are neither for the taxpayer nor governmental. You're to come up with reasonable determinations. And that's as applicable in 1964 as it is today.
Is there a certain type of person that you've found who tends to gravitate toward working for the IRS? And what maybe is it about that person or personality type that would be helpful for people to understand?
Well, there's a system called Myers-Briggs. And in Myers-Briggs, they break up into 16 different personality factors. And the IRS actually gives that test to all their managers to help them realize we're all different, different personalities, and your employees are different personalities. As a manager, you need to adapt to them. The most common personality at the IRS is an INTJ, introverted versus extroverted, intuitive, big N on intuitive, very much a thinking, analytical type, and they come to judgments quickly. So the most common personality type, over 50% in management, are INTJs. If you think about that, most folks that work for the IRS tend to be more introverted. They are technically sound. They like to follow the rules. In terms of ethics, we fall basically into two categories, according to the folks who are experts in ethics. Either we are, when push comes to shove, we're pushed against the wall, we either are follow the rules or the end justifies the means. And most of the folks at the IRS are follow the rules.
So, and it's fascinating. You talk about, you know, those folks in management who, you know, they're INTJs. And that last part, the judgment part, I think is really interesting, because when somebody's got their mind made up, that can be a difficult conversation when they're quick to reach those decisions. And you talk a little bit about, in your most recent book, understanding the decision maker. And I guess it kind of works on two levels, both who they are at the service and also kind of how they're wired. How does understanding those two things, I guess, empower somebody when you're coming in as a practitioner, for example, and your valuation's being challenged? How does understanding those dynamics of the individual in a position to make a decision, how can that be helpful? How can that better inform the approach that you take in those conversations?
Okay, I'll take this in two parts. First, who is the decision maker? As a valuer, typically, you will interact with another valuer at the IRS. In looking at the organization, that valuer has a manager. So you've got the valuer, and the manager of that valuer is called an engineering manager at the IRS. Those folks coordinate what's happening on the valuation issue. But they are reporting to or providing a consultation service to the decision maker. So for example, in estate and gift, which is in the small business self-employed division, there's an estate tax attorney, that's the revenue agent. That person controls the case. That is a decision maker, but the ultimate decision maker is the estate and gift tax manager, the group manager of that estate and gift tax attorney. So knowing that the valuer you're talking to and you have an interaction with, that's really not the ultimate decision maker. The ultimate decision maker is going to be the agent and the agent's manager. But then I come back to, it is all about relationships. It's all about connecting with others. It's all about judiciously educating them to work towards a negotiated closure. Valuation is an art and a science. And knowing that, what we want to do is we want to, with those four folks, know geographically where they are. They're spread out all over the country today. that actually means something today in terms of how that geographic location may handle this issue. There's not a uniform way in which the IRS handles it. So on those four people, I work with my clients and say, let's determine who they are. Let's determine where they are. Then let's do some analysis on them relative to social media and learn all we can about them. Because what we want to do is develop a connecting relationship. This is hard in a short period of time. We want to develop a connecting relationship with them. And then, instead of coming in to say why I'm right and you're wrong, you want to come in and understand from their perspective why they've come up with what they've done. And maybe they've had enough time to do it, but in general, they haven't had enough time to do it. So they haven't done fully due diligence. But listen to them with where they're coming from. Don't judge them. Accept what they're saying. Even if you disagree, just accept what they're saying. Listen to what they have to say. They're under pressure to close cases timely. But then, you're there to judiciously educate them. Have you thought about this? Did you know that? Did you understand something else? So, for example, on a discount for lack of marketability, it's common that maybe it's a common adjustment in business valuation. Go back and look at the IRS job aid. There are 33 factors to consider. There may be factors in your initial appraisal that you didn't consider. Go back and look at those. Some of those may be applicable. Bring those up as additional information. Ask if the IRS person might think, given that this fact is there, might that have increased the DLOM? The answer is yes. Get them to say yes and agree. Then as we go through this, go back and revisit with them, given the additional information I've given to you, do you think that might increase the overall DLOM? Yes. Then work with the IRS to determine what might be applicable for a DLOM that's somewhere between where they started with and where you were originally when you were through with your report. You now have new information that they can consider, and they look at you as being someone who's trying to collaborate with them rather than to be antagonistic with them.
So sort of not trying to hammer them and say, oh, come on, just I'm right, I'm correct, I'm the expert, but giving them enough reason to reconsider their position, I guess taking it the next step, having, because they've got to go, I mean, you talk about there's this whole chain of command that has to happen. So it's convincing that valuer to turn around and say, hey, you know what? We didn't quite get it right. We actually need to do something different. And having them be willing to put themselves on the line to take that position with their manager, convince their manager, turn around, go up the chain. I mean, it can sound a little daunting, I guess, because of all the links in the chain that you have to deal with. But the approach that you're talking about in terms of trying to really, it's education more than anything. Like, hey, you know, this is what I saw. Why do you not see it? It's a very different process, I think, than what most people consider when dealing with the IRS.
And sometimes you can run into folks that I ask clients, do you want to be right or do you want to win? And if what you want to do is win, you want to find a way to resolve this with each other. But sometimes you also run into folks that are very much in their ways. They're not going to move. This is what I have. That's what it is. And in those cases, it might be necessary to elevate in management. And depending on what the issue might be, sometimes there's time to elevate within management within the engineering valuation function. Sometimes it's appropriate to elevate within the revenue agent area and the ultimate decision maker, the revenue agent's manager's area. So depending on what the issue might be, it may be necessary to elevate in management to have somebody else take a look at it and give it a second look. And once in a while, it even requires going up to the third level or the territory manager. That's rare. I've been in business 8 years. And in 8 years, there have been three times we've elevated something. Well, now it's four, just another. Four times that we've elevated something to the territory manager.
So you kind of dovetailed into something else I wanted to ask. Because again, in the book, you talk about, and you said it today, 1 in 20 are on some kind of a performance improvement plan. And then, you know, there's life, right? That can, right. And that's true, public sector, private sector, small, large, anything in between. You know, that you're going to come across people sometimes, and I've had these experiences at you know, other agencies where you run into somebody and you're like, they're just not, I don't know what's going on, but there's something not quite right here. You know, how should you as an outside practitioner representing that taxpayer client, how should you handle those conversations when you just kind of know that you're looking at somebody and they're less than stellar? And you have an issue, you talk about escalating it, but what are the kind of the effective strategies for escalating to get a proper response? Kind of what's the conversation like when you have to escalate an issue?
First of all, document. I'm going to say that document, document, document. Write down the date, write down the time, write down what they did or said, write down what you did or said. That's a record. Typically, if someone is
less than stellar, using your commentary,
and they're not performing their job as they should, they will make multiple inappropriate comments or multiple inappropriate responses in writing, orally, whatever. You document that. Once you've documented that you have several of those, you are in a position where you'd say, you know, I'd like to talk with your manager. And under IRS publication number one, your rights as a taxpayer, you have the right to talk to anybody's manager. So no one can say, no, you can't talk to my manager. Yes, you get to talk to the manager. And then when you find out the manager's contact information, phone number or email, you would contact that manager and say, manager, I want to talk to you about some concerns I have. Now, having done this with clients, usually clients come in, they're angry, and they say, this is what happened. They're talking about generalizations. And I'm like, we can't deal with generalizations. We have to deal with something specific. So we need to have the documentation. And when that's happened, and it's been elevated in management, management generally has them on an opportunity period. But they have to give them an opportunity to perform. And they may perform satisfactorily, great. They may not perform satisfactorily and have to be terminated. Most often what happens is they're being coached, and the employee also realizes this isn't the right job for me. I'm not happy here for whatever reason. I need to go somewhere else. But with this kind of documentation, it actually helps the manager. So I've had a half dozen cases, this is again in an 8-year period, where we've documented that, given it to the manager. Manager has said thank you and withdrawn from the case. Totally withdrawn from the case. I've had another, I'll say, couple dozen cases where they've said, okay, you're right. We're going to take that person off. We're going to put somebody else on. The new person comes in and their perspective is the case has been open for a long time, hasn't developed properly. It's not like they're going to open up the case and look at everything. They're going to come in and typically do what's called a touch. They came in and looked at something on the case, addressed a given issue. It may have been a no change. It may be some small adjustment, but they will come in and work the case, and then they'll leave. So for you as a taxpayer, it's actually a win. Again, I'm not looking to be right. I'm going to win. If you want to win with the IRS and be able to move on, you want closure, that's an effective way to raise that in management and have management make the decision to either remove or and replace or to withdraw from a given case.
So you talked about, you know, you have these examples. It's probably somebody already on a, you know, opportunity period, improvement plan kind of situation. You know, kind of from your experience having been in management at IRS, have you seen instances where, you know, it doesn't always kind of go like, all right, this person, it's not working out, they're going to leave. Have you seen examples too where maybe that constructive feedback, when properly documented but also properly framed and presented, winds up actually kind of, you know, waking somebody up, helping them improve their performance, and then they wind up sticking around a little bit?
I would say looking at 10 times, 8 out of the 10, the person comes around. 2 out of 10 or 1 out of 5, that person leaves. Either they decide to leave or they're terminated. And at the IRS, when you're terminated, we always give the option, when I worked there, we always gave the option of, do you want to resign today versus being terminated? Most people will resign because they don't want to be terminated or have that on their record. But 8 out of the 10 people who had this issue also realized, either if I'm going to stay here, I have to perform. I don't just get paid for showing up. So they do improve, and they do well. And they typically don't become your stars. They don't become the top 10%. But they clearly become a solid performer. So they're like of an A to C. They're probably going to be a B or C performer going forward. And they may even have lapses in the future. And there are generally reasons why they had this lapse. And that ties back into employee assistance programs. Something happened, and their performance dropped. If I'm seriously concerned about my son, who's a drug addict and has all kinds of issues, I'm not focusing everything on my job when I come to work that day. I'm worried about what's going on in my family. That's usually when performance drops. So documenting performance, the employee assistance program with that, the employee can come back and be an excellent employee going forward.
So interestingly enough, but it sounds like, yeah, in the micro of that single transaction, yeah, you want to win, as you point out, but you know, we kind of forget the humanity involved. I mean, you're still dealing with people on a daily basis. So it's not just about, okay, I want to win. You could also kind of frame it in your own mind as, look, I really don't, you know, wish ill on this person. I don't want them to do poorly because then it just makes my life easier when I turn around and bring it up. You're as much helping that person as well as that manager when you raise the concerns.
And keep in mind, this is a definite minority of the cases. Most of the cases, the folks at the IRS are there to try and work with folks and resolve issues, especially if the other party wants to work with the IRS. For the folks who come in and want to butt heads,
and tell the IRS why they're wrong. Well, the IRS can butt heads back pretty hard, and they can also put additional resources on it. And a number of my clients, usually when they've come to me, they've already butted heads. So I have to work on de-escalation from the client and also de-escalation with the IRS so that we can come back in to try and build the relationship going forward.
So again, 28 years at IRS, 11 as a territory manager.
And I headed up business valuation during that time.
And so you have seen and done and touched as much of IRS as anybody ever will. Probably a slightly unfair question, more so because now you can answer it since you're not with the IRS anymore. With all that time there, if there is one thing that you would change about how the IRS does business, whether it's specifically in the valuation sections or just kind of on a global scale, was there one thing that when you left, you're like, I'm glad I'm not going to deal with that anymore?
The IRS, in an attempt to produce more as policy is presented by Congress, is not doing the quality review that they've done historically. They've reduced training for their technical employees and valuation by over 90%. So the IRS is having a hard time maintaining quality on a consistent basis across the program. So from my perspective, when I was still there, there was quality review. We had a report writing initiative to improve writing. We sent folks off to conferences like the conference we're at here today with ASA here in New York. Today, they're not here, and they're not getting the training. And to maintain credentials, that's done by the employees on their own. They're not supporting them in obtaining those credentials. So given that what had happened historically and how funds have been cut today, I feel for the folks who are doing this job, and I look at them as they have a hard job. They have not necessarily the most current training or understanding and valuation. And so to be there to connect with them, to listen to them and their concerns, and then to educate them with things they don't know, to try and work towards negotiating closure that's acceptable to both parties, is really the key today.
So obviously the title of this podcast is Stories of Value. Again, long time at the IRS, you probably have some stories. Is there one that sticks out to you, a story or an experience from your career that it was either just funny or enlightening, or what's, you know, I always tell people it's the story at the bar. If you're standing at the bar and you got to tell one story, what's the story?
Well, I tend to focus today more on my interactions with the IRS as a consultant. As I think back at my career, just in general, folks at the IRS have a sense of humor. Folks at the IRS are people. So when you just said talk about what happens like at the bar afterwards and having fun, when IRS folks get together, they tell stories with one another too. So they can tell stories that are interesting about what happened with a given taxpayer and how things materialized and what they did and how silly this was or that was or whatever. That's kind of at the bar with the IRS folks. But today, when I'm talking with folks, I'm generally addressing where they have issues. And it's not the story at the bar, but it's how can we address something going forward. And today, what I'm finding is oftentimes various parties at the IRS have taken ownership of an issue. And as they've taken ownership of an issue, there's been miscommunication within the IRS and actually information not being shared with other members of the IRS team to come to a better decision because someone wants a decision to go a given way. So not the story at the bar, but rather what came to my mind is there are too many times today when the IRS hasn't necessarily followed their own procedures or processes like they should, and that's negatively impacting taxpayers. And for a person who worked at the IRS for 28 years, this is very discouraging because I saw what can happen when you do things right and you're there to work with the taxpayers. And in their most recent hiring in the last 10 years, they've been hiring experienced people. But historically, the IRS used to bring people in at a lower grade level and put them through a whole year worth of training where they learned the culture. And the culture was to do the right thing and be reasonable with taxpayers. And today, a number of people come in who are former vice presidents of tax or tax managers or whatever, they come to the IRS. And they come in with a perspective of this is how the IRS works. And they oftentimes don't know the historical culture. And that's something that's hard at the IRS because it results in an inconsistency around the country. And cultures are different in different places. And that's impacting to not have the overall IRS culture to serve and to be a public servant. And instead, it's becoming more of looking out for the government rather than for what's reasonable.
So it all goes back to that guidance from the 1960s and ties back into, no, we're here to just get it right.
We're here to try and do what's reasonable.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for sitting down with me. I greatly appreciate it. This has been ASA Stories of Value, where we take a look at the human side of the appraisal profession. I have been your host, John Russell. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and we look forward to you joining us on a future podcast. Take care. ASA Stories of Value is brought to you by Tagnify. With an affordable, all-in-one solution, let Tagnify simplify your guideline public company method and transaction comps. With robust data sets, easy integration into your models, and now M&A transaction data, Tagnify makes your BV process more profitable. For more info or to schedule a demo, visit Tagnify.com today. Tagnify, the modern financial data platform for innovative business valuation professionals.